House Judiciary Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:05 p.m. on Monday, January 31st, 2011. Present are Representatives Keller, Representative Lynn, Representative Holmes, Representative Pruitt, and myself, Representative Thompson. Let the record also reflect that Chair Gatto is still back in his district and cannot be present. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear an overview from the Department of Law, Criminal Division. The Chair has also requested information concerning the status of the Governor's bills on sexual assault and domestic violence that were passed in the last legislature. Committee members should feel free to ask questions as they arise. Deputy Attorney General Richard Svobodny and our legislative liaison, Assistant Attorney General Annie Carpinetti. Mr. Svobodny and Ms. Carpinetti, please come to the table and begin your presentation to the House Judiciary Committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Rick Svobodny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. Over my left shoulder is Annie Carpinetti. Why don't you stand up, Annie? Who is an Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Thank you. If I could just interrupt for a moment, Representative Grunberg has now joined us for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you. Let me start by indicating that the mission of the Department of Law is to prosecute crimes and to provide legal services to the state government for the protection and benefit of Alaskan citizens. We divide that mission into four core services, of which the Criminal Division is primarily involved with the first but has involvement with the remaining three. Those core services are protecting the safety and financial well-being of Alaskans, fostering conditions for responsible development of natural resources. Normally, you wouldn't think that's a Criminal Division matter, but as I go through our Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals, you'll see that we have somebody dedicated precisely to doing that. Protecting the fiscal integrity of the state, and we do that also through our Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals, and promoting good governance. And in that, you'll hear, well, you all know the work that Ms. Carpinetti does in trying to provide good legal advice to all the members of the legislature involving matters that deal with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. There are three divisions in the Department of Law. First, the Criminal Division, Civil Division, and then Administrative Services. In the Civil Division, there's 162 lawyers. In the Criminal Division, there's 201. In the Administrative Services section, you say, there is one lawyer. That person happens to be kind of an important lawyer in that section. That's the Attorney General. He wants me to say that.
Not from his
two employees here.
Which remain employees.
That's right. As I said, there's 162 lawyers in the Civil Division, and their total budget is $49.9 million. The Criminal Division's budget, at 121 lawyers, is $30.9 million. The Criminal Division's budget is divided into several offices. We have 13 offices, district attorney's offices, located around the state. Anchorage, Barrow, Bethel, Dillingham, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, Kodiak, Kotzebue, Ketchikan, Nome, Palmer, and Sitka. We have nine district attorneys for those 13 offices. Four of the 13 offices are satellite offices. For example, Sitka is a satellite office. Then the district attorney that supervises the Sitka office is the Juneau district attorney's office. Barrow, supervised by the district attorney in Fairbanks. Kotzebue's supervised by the district attorney in Nome, and Dillingham is supervised by the Anchorage district attorney's office. Up until very recently, all of those satellite offices were staffed by one lawyer, one paralegal and a law office assistant. And this year, the governor in his budget request is asked to increase the number of lawyers in Kotzebue by one. That person has a caseload now of about 844. He has a caseload of 844 cases, and the caseload in the state for the different offices run from a low of 180 to a high of 844. You can see the mean is somewhere about 330. So even putting another lawyer in Kotzebue doesn't put him down to the mean. Last Tuesday, the Attorney General asked for a snapshot of where the district attorneys were as far as doing trials. He picked a wonderful day. Last Tuesday was the 25th, and I say he picked a wonderful day, not because of the number of cases that he had, but he happened to catch the day that I was doing my first trial in 4 years, so I got counted in those statistics. We were doing 11 felony trials across the state and 9 misdemeanor trials across the state. Some of those trials are the trials that you read about every day when you look at the daily paper. Two of them, one of them is of actually international renown that had a 48 hours and another TV, one of those TV shows done about the first trial, and that's the case of Rochelle Waterman. The other one that certainly has received a lot of attention is Mr. Reynolds, who was an Anchorage police officer and who was charged with sexually assaulting several women. We received last year about 8,284 felony cases to be reviewed for prosecution. And we ended up, and that was, the year before it was 7,700 roughly. So there was about a 7% increase in the cases, the felony cases that we received from police to screen for prosecution. We prosecuted 5,650 of those cases, which was roughly what we did the year before at 5,352. As far as misdemeanor cases, we received 23,500, which was up from 23,200 the year before. We prosecuted over 19,800 of those cases. Roughly in 1 year, we prosecuted a little bit over 25,000 cases. I want to just stop for a minute about talking about the Department of Law and mention Anchorage and Juneau for a moment. Anchorage and Juneau, the municipalities have chosen to prosecute misdemeanor cases, and they do roughly, those two communities do roughly 9,000 misdemeanor cases a year. So really, when I talk about 20,000 misdemeanor cases, the number of actual cases being prosecuted across between Anchorage, Juneau, and the Department of Law is about 30,000 misdemeanor cases each year. And I mention that because they do some of the harder misdemeanor cases. Just as a practical matter, in trying driving while under the influence, that's one of the kind of the more technical types of trials that people have to do. for the lawyers here. There are a lot more steps you have to take in introducing evidence in those trials than you would have in, say, a theft trial or even sometimes in a homicide trial. The other big area that they're doing are misdemeanor assault cases, and a lot of those cases are domestic violence cases. So it would be remiss of me not to mention the contribution that they make to keeping the public safe in Alaska. So I've gone over kind of what people think of mostly is what the criminal division does. That is 13 district attorney's offices from Ketchikan to Barrow. But that's not all that we do. We have an office of special prosecutions and appeals. The appellate section of special prosecutions and appeals does exactly what it sounds like. They represent the state when criminal matters are appealed. The kind of the section that the other part of the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals that don't get as much attention is the special prosecution part. Those areas include environmental crimes. This year we've had several incidents of toxic spills that we've prosecuted both people who are running, who are engaging in those spills, from small gas stations that are polluting the area by letting pouring out the oil from their car repairs, to big canneries that are discharging ammonia into the water. So our environmental law sections of special prosecutions and appeals is quite busy. We have all these different sections that I'm going through, there are one lawyer in each of these areas. We have a lawyer who does mostly commercial fish and game violations. But when I say mostly, sometimes he does where it's cases that aren't commercial but happen to be of statewide import, that there may be an issue that would affect the prosecution or defending of those resources. We have a person who deals with both the permanent fund dividend and welfare fraud, a child support enforcement lawyer, an alcohol interdiction lawyer. All of our DA's offices are involved in alcohol abuse type cases, but in areas that are restricted from the use or possession of alcohol, where there's a lot of importation, we found it important to have somebody who had kind of a statewide involvement in that area where a lot of alcohol is interdicted from Anchorage going out to bush communities. We have a Medicaid fraud unit, and I would say a white collar crime unit, but that means these, when I say unit, we're talking about one lawyer each. White collar crime does just exactly what it sounds like, fairly sophisticated criminal offenses that are not the drug, sex, or assaults that you normally think of. They're everything from tampering with votes to become unionized to contractors who are bilking some of our elderly citizens of their life savings with promises to do siding on the home or to rebuild a new home. I said that those areas don't get much publicity. The next one gets a little bit more publicity, and that's our cold case unit that specializes in the prosecution of criminal cases that are several years old, and in the past you've heard, seen on TV and read in the paper about some of those cases. And then finally, we have a rural prosecution unit, and that actually does consist of more than one lawyer. That rural prosecution unit is designed to do two things. It's designed to take major cases in small offices where that case coming into that, a new case, a complex case coming into that office would take up so much of the time of the one lawyer there, or the two lawyers, three lawyers in that office, that they need outside help to keep other things going. And that unit is also designed to be kind of a mentor for the people in the Bush areas. A lot of kind of prosecution is traditionally an area where young lawyers right out of law school are hired, and they need a lot of training. We find that especially true in filling some of our Bush positions, so we want to make sure that those people get the best training that we can, and we have had this rural prosecution unit that three lawyers, probably all three are somewhere about 75 years total experience with the three lawyers. They probably wouldn't like me saying that, but they do have a lot of experience. We have one other part of the criminal division, and that's the central office, and that's kind of the administrative hub. It includes myself. It includes Sue McLean, who's the director of the division, and some of you know her from her testimony here last year and the year before. Annie Carpinetti, who is a legislative liaison for the criminal division. We have two lawyers who do nothing but change that a little bit. We have two lawyers who represent the Division of Corrections. One of those lawyers deals a lot with administrative matters from them, adequate timekeeping, establishing new programs, and the other uses all her time in defending the state against inmates who are suing the Department of Corrections for, bologna sandwiches on the day it's supposed to be tuna fish sandwiches or whatever. I don't mean to belittle that. I mean, sometimes there are, legitimate torts that occur in jail, but a lot of them are really, are like that. So she spends all her time doing that, and then we have one lawyer who represents the Department of Public Safety. I'm going to switch, Mr. Chairman, into talking a little bit less about the Department of Law now, unless people have questions they want to ask now, and go to what you and Chairman Gatto asked about, and that is what happened with the legislation that passed last year. There were four major parts of an initiative by the governor last year to reduce sexual assault and domestic violence in the next 10 years. A major part of that initiative deals with not the the cops and the courts and the cages but deals with how to prevent sexual assault, domestic violence, how to get victims of domestic violence and sexual assault appropriate treatment, how to change the culture of in dealing with those offenses. And that major initiative didn't pass through this committee. It was more budgetary issues, but there was a lot of work put in by members of this committee last year on that. But there wasn't one specific piece of legislation that dealt with that. That was mostly programmatic approaches to dealing with sexual assault and domestic violence. But this committee spent a lot of time and a lot of work on three major pieces of legislation. Major piece of legislation that dealt with bail, a piece of legislation that dealt with directly sexual assault and domestic violence, and a piece of legislation that dealt with post-conviction DNA matters. And let me start with the last one first. the legislature last year passed a mechanism, a process for people to seek relief from a criminal conviction if there was sufficient evidence that they didn't commit the an offense and that DNA would be able to exonerate them from that from the conviction. To my knowledge, as of yet, no one has filed an application, either under the bill that the legislature passed last session or under the pre-existing scheme that the Court of Appeals established when we didn't have a statutory process. So that doesn't mean there's not cases out there. I think there are two cases, there may be three cases out there under the old approach. None under the new approach, and I think that's just a matter of timing. I mean, it's not to say that this was a great piece of legislation or a bad piece of legislation. It's just a matter of happenstance up until this point where we haven't had any litigation involving the post-conviction DNA bill. The next one was the bail bill. And Alaska passed the statutes, its initial statutes involving, last year's bill was the first total review of the bail statutes since 1966. And it made several changes that bringing the Alaska's bail statutes up to where the federal law was and other state laws who had reformed their bills not so long ago. I can tell you from personal experience from that trial last week when the person was convicted of sexual assault in the second degree, the court reviewed the bail statute and it had been changed to indicate that people who had been convicted of sexual assault offenses, they had an obligation to show by clear and convincing evidence that they were not a danger to the community or a flight risk. And the gentleman, or I had my first opportunity to deal with the bail bill, had difficult time explaining how he wasn't a danger since he was just convicted of a sexual assault on a woman, and that after that he had physically assaulted his wife, and so he was remanded to custody after being found guilty of sexual assault in the second degree. So, at least in my experience with the bail bill, it's been working. However, I should tell you that the day before the bill took effect, the state was sued by the Association of Defense Lawyers being represented by the American Civil Liberties Union. They said 13 provisions of the bail bill that was passed were unconstitutional, and they asked for injunctive relief. I'm not going to go through all those 13 areas that they said were unconstitutional, but they dealt from things as varied as a judge having the authority as a condition of bail to say that one had to follow their doctor's orders and take medication if necessary. They claimed that seeking or maintaining work, and again, the court wasn't required to order somebody maintain work, but to seek and maintain work to be released on bail was unconstitutional. If the offense was a drug offense or an alcohol-related offense, upon a showing of reasonable suspicion, a court could order, could order that a person's car or home be searched for alcohol or drugs. The legislature expanded from a requirement that somebody have a bail hearing within 24 hours of arrest to 48 hours from arrest, and the ACLU claimed that that likewise was unconstitutional. And finally, the bill that you passed had a provision, a cooling off provision for sexual assault and domestic violence cases that required that person, where there was a finding of probable cause that the person had committed domestic violence assault, had a 20-day cooling off period before they could go back to their residence, and then there were some requirements to determine whether or not they could. As I said, there were 13 things. Those are kind of a representative sample. There was a hearing for injunctive relief to stop the state from enforcing or asking courts to enforce the bail statute. The judge who was assigned the case found one and only one area of the bill that warranted, in his view, injunctive relief, meaning stop enforcing the law. And that was the domestic violence and the domestic violence provision. And I know that some of you weren't here, but this was a provision of law that first came into effect in 1996 that just made it an absolute prohibition in a domestic violence case that the person returned to the home. The Court of Appeals, in a case called Williams, said that that was unconstitutional. The bill took into consider, and this committee took an approach that was different than the 1996 version that prohibited somebody from ever returning during the pendency of that case, and set standards that are a framework in which somebody could return to the home once there was this cooling off period and people were safe. The trial judge thought that was too close to what the Court of Appeals had said in Williams that we couldn't do, and so Judge Michalski enjoined not the executive branch of government from asking that the courts impose that, but from judges imposing that as a condition. We appealed to the Supreme Court. It's actually a petition to the Supreme Court. And the ACLU also did. And there was a 2-2 split by the Supreme Court as to whether they were going to hear it. So that meant it wasn't heard. It's back in the trial court. So the only, actually, the Supreme Court did mention that one judge can't stop another judge from making up his or her mind, and that Judge Michalski really couldn't enjoin other superior court or other judges from following the law that was set out by the legislature. That's dialed back before Judge Michalski. We're asking that a couple things. We're asking first that the court dismiss the case, that the lawyers don't have any standing. They didn't have any clients that were subject to the provisions that they were talking about. So there's really no case. There's no facts that somebody can look at. So we're seeking to have it dismissed because there's no for the lawyer no standing, and there are cases that have dealt with that. The Alaska Supreme Court and the trial courts have dealt with standing. And so that's where we're at with it now. Basically, what it means is, where we're at right now is that all the provisions of the bail statute, the state can argue for. The judge never enjoined us about arguing any of them, just on the one he enjoined the court from enforcing. The courts always had the ability to make a determination whether it was an appropriate thing to order somebody to stay away from their home. But what this legislation did was make it mandatory for a 20-day cooling-off period. So the trial courts, that's an up-in-the-air question where that's going to end. But we're back in the trial court. We'll get all these 13 areas litigated, but that answers the question, I hope. Maybe way too much about what happened with the bail bill. The other bill that there'd been some legal action in is the bill that dealt with domestic violence and sexual assault. That has been attacked in one specific area, and that's AS 1161-128, and that really was kind of a major issue that was before this committee last year. The statute used to be the crime of electronic distribution of indecent materials to minors. The legislature changed it to distribution of indecent materials to a minor. It had been before that if you transmitted over the internet items that depicted or pictures that depicted certain conduct that are enumerated in the statute, that was a crime. Last year, it was broadened to include any distribution of those materials to somebody under 16 or to somebody that the person doing the distributing to thought was under 16. The ACLU and this time Tidal Wave Books, along with some other media entities, sued the state in federal court asking for injunctive relief, that is, that we not enforce the new statute and that we not enforce the pre-existing statute, because they were saying that the statute that has been there for 5 years before you changed it last year was unconstitutional. Let me just tell you what the elements of the offense are, and then I'll tell you the arguments. Let me stop. Mr. Chairman, am I going way too long on this stuff for you? Okay. Okay. Right now, the offense is distribution of indecent material to a minor. And it requires that the offender, the person being charged, is 18 years of age or older, that they transmit to somebody, whether it's handing them a picture or sending it over the internet or mailing it, they distribute indecent material. And in Alaska, we didn't define, up until this bill, pornography, except by describing what specifically items that were prohibited. So if the item distributed was a depiction of sexual penetration, for example, or masturbation, and I'm not going to go through the list, but they're specified types of conduct. So if you're 18 years of age or older, you distribute depictions of this conduct that's set out in the statute, and if that conduct is to somebody under 16 years of age or somebody that the person believed was under 16 years of age, and it was harmful to a child. Now when we added harmful to a child, when you added harmful to a child last year, you described that as basically the kind of the definition of pornography that people have used since the 60s and 70s. And let me just kind of run through that definition. Harmful to a child meaning that you applied contemporary community standards would indicate that the depictions would rouse the prurient interest of somebody 16. There was no social redeeming value, and that an adult would reasonably believe that that the community wouldn't accept that these would be the type of things that a 16-year-old should have, then it harms a child. That definition, and I didn't do it verbatim, but that definition, and I'm telling you this because it just irks me a little bit. That definition was proposed by the ACLU. They said, you know, for this bill to be constitutional, we need the definition of harm to a child in there. And you accepted what they said. And now, guess what they're saying? That definition is not constitutional. They have two arguments. Actually, they have three arguments. Their arguments are this, that definition is not constitutional because it is not clear enough. People really don't know what it means. And that a reasonable that people don't know or wouldn't know that they're necessarily distributing these prescribed materials. And their argument there has some merit. Their argument there is if you're a bookstore or if you're Amazon.com and somebody is buying a book over the internet, you don't know what their age is. Nor do you know whether we're going to meet this definition of harmful to a child because somebody at Amazon doesn't sit down and read every book that comes into them. And so that's what the bookstores, the libraries would say, you know, I don't really have any control over that. But actually, we believe they do, because for a crime to occur, you have to have two mental states. You have to knowingly distribute. That's pretty easy. You didn't do it accidentally. You didn't drop it off at the wrong person's house. And you have to act with reckless disregard that the person is under 16 years of age. So, I mean, that's our response to what, in essence, is a First Amendment argument, both in that the definition that the ACLU gives us isn't good enough to define what's define what is prohibited conduct, and that the sellers of legitimate material to adults don't know that they're selling to children. And the state's response to that is, yes, you can't be convicted unless you act recklessly in distributing to somebody under 16. Or the other way you commit this crime is you believe that the person was under 16. So Amazon would have to believe that the person was under 16 or act recklessly as to whether they were under 16. So that's, and they have this argument that it violates the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Federal Constitution. If it violates the Commerce Clause of the Federal Constitution, I guess we're in a lot of hurt, because every time you regulate anything, change in any way, increase or decrease oil taxes, that affects interstate commerce. They would be saying you couldn't do that. We're really confident about winning on the Interstate Commerce Clause. The First Amendment is a tougher issue. The trial court, the federal court, enjoined us, said that we couldn't prosecute prosecute these cases, and we asked for a clarification. Does that mean we can't investigate them? And the court said, no, that doesn't mean you can't investigate them. We have a case on appeal. The question was to the federal court, can we go forward with our appeal in this case? And the judge hasn't answered that question, so it's we haven't gone forward with that appeal. We don't want to be violating a federal court order. But where we are in that case is that's the only provision of a comprehensive sexual assault and domestic violence bill that was passed last year. The both sides have asked that the court decide the issue on the law. That's motion for summary judgment. However, the state also has asked the trial judge before, federal trial judge, before you do that, you should remand. We've asked that the court remand it to, it would be the Alaska Supreme Court, because this is a state law question, and the state should, it should go through the state courts before it gets to the federal court. So that's where we are with last year's legislation. I have one more area that I'd like to talk to you about, but if you have any questions.
Dave Grunberg, you have a question?
Yeah, having read that opinion, I assume it's the same opinion. Was that Judge Beislein?
Yes. Through the chair.
There's only one opinion on it. It's only one case.
Through the chair. Actually, there's one case pending. And right now, all that's there is an enjoining us from prosecuting those cases. So there is a very abbreviated. I would say it's more an order than an opinion. We haven't got to that stage yet. That's where we're going. Right.
We're talking about the same document.
The same.
You and I.
Through the chair, I'm not sure that I understand.
Well, my recollection is, having read the opinion, it's based on a U.S. Supreme Court case and a whole lot of other cases. It seemed that the judge thought he was on very firm legal ground in granting the preliminary injunction, didn't he?
Through the chair, I think that's correct. I mean, that's correct.
Thank you.
Now, the other things I just kind of wanted to point out to the committee that are issues that are out there for the Department of Law is the governor's introduced some changes to dealing with sexual assault legislation, which will be heard before this committee in a short while. Excuse me. One of the things that I would like to address the committee on at that time is the status of the state in regards to federal legislation dealing with legislation that's kind of colloquially known as the Adam Walsh Act, which deals with sex offender registration. But that's an issue that's out there. The state of Alaska needs to comply with the Adam Walsh Act by the 27th of July of this year, or lose some federal grant money. For the last 3 years, I addressed a letter to the chair of the House and other bodies, judiciary committees, dealing with the state that's coming up. There are a lot of reasons to comply, and there's a lot of reasons not to comply, and I just want to make sure that everybody understands what the issues are before final decisions are made.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Mr. Svobodny, do I understand you saying that there's a federal law, and you've written to the chair of this committee three times asking that this committee take that issue up?
Through the chair, not quite close, though. I have written three times to the chair saying, you know, there's this federal law out there. Here are the issues to the state. No one asked. I just wanted to make sure that the chair of the committee knew what was pending in with this federal legislation.
The reason I'm asking is because I do not recall seeing a copy or having that correspondence brought to the attention of the committee. And I see another member to my left here shaking his head too, and the third member who's common in this last several years. I don't know if you recall us hearing about this at all. I don't. I am concerned if a communication like that is sent to this committee and the members don't know about it. And I hope that that doesn't happen again. I'm sure the current chair wouldn't do that. And I hope the committee, I mean the department would make sure that members get that correspondence if something like that comes up in the future. The members need to know if something like that concerns the Department of Law. We should know about correspondence like that, and I'll leave it at that.
Chair recognizes Representative Lynn.
Thank you. Well, I suppose part of that would depend on whether the letter was sent to the chair of this committee or sent to the committee. If it's sent to the committee, I would think everybody on the committee sent to the chair, and that would be the chair's business what to do with it, to distribute it to other members or not. So I don't know whom the letter was addressed to, the committee as a whole or to the chair.
I would have to say that Chair Gatto will probably address this when he's back. He'll be back next week, and I'm sure he'll inform us.
Well, he knows I will stand also. Corrected if I overstated what I should have said.
Representative Lynn?
I just going to say that the current Chair Gatto may not have known about it because the previous chair is no longer in the legislature, and who knows?
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair, I can clear that up. It was not sent to Representative Gatto. It was sent to the chair of this committee, but not to Representative Gatto. In years past, I'm just telling you that in the past years, we've sent a letter to the chair of the committee, not dealing with the issue, but just pointing out that there was this issue that's out there. I may have unintentionally overstated it. I said there was this deadline of July this year. Yes, it's a deadline, but it's not a, if you don't do it by July 27th, you're stuck for forever. It's a deadline that's means that we would lose a small amount of federal money. Actually, I think in 2013 or something like that. But you can come back and get it. But I guess my point was, I do want the committee to know what the issues are when they look at the sexual assault legislation this year. The only other kind of issues that remain, I know last year there was a lot of discussion in the Judiciary Committee about safety issues for prosecutors across the state. I mean, we continued to work on that, both Anchorage, Fairbanks, Barrow, and in Juneau. We are trying to hire somebody to do an audit of all the facilities that we have in the state for those issues. That continues to be a concern of mine, and it certainly is a concern of the DAs that are working around the state. And then just kind of finally, I'll just leave it at that. That was the final issue I wanted to bring to your attention.
All right. Is that complete the presentation?
It does, yes.
Now, Mr. We have other questions. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm batting about 10%.
I apologize. Go right ahead.
Was nothing personal. Okay, let's talk about the two things here that you've talked about, Mr. Spokane. And I don't mean to sound critical or anything. I'm not. What is Adam Walsh, the Adam Walsh Act? Tell us in a little more detail. I'm not at all familiar with that. And what's going on?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I gladly do it, but I didn't come prepared to do it today, so I'm going to be leaving some things out, okay?
Would you prefer to respond in writing?
I can send copies of letters that I sent in the past. Let me just explain kind of what it is.
Sure.
Adam Walsh is was a young boy who was murdered in Florida. His father has been very active nationally in Americans Most Wanted, and in attending and getting legislation that is helpful, he believes, to the protection of children across the country. The federal government, about 5 years ago, passed a piece of legislation that they have tried, that, let me just hold kind of that thought. For about the last 20 years, federal government has periodically passed pieces of legislation and has said to the states, you have to comply with certain provisions of sex offender registration that they set out, or a child kidnapping legislation that they set out about registering as a sex offender or a child kidnapper. Alaska has, I think there have been three predecessors to the Adam Walsh Act, and as they've and the Alaska has made a determination to follow the federal law that has come about before Adam Walsh. Adam Walsh has provisions to it that are different than Alaska's Sex Offender Registration Act, and substantially different in many respects. For example, Alaska does not require juveniles to register as a sex offender. The Adam Walsh Act requires that. Adam Walsh Act requires that if we have a two-tier system, that you're required to register for a 15-year period or life, depending upon either the nature of the sex offense or the number of times that you have been convicted. Federal government has a three-tier system. And I'm sorry that if I get this wrong, it's either 10 or 15 years first jump, then 25 years, and then life. The federal so that would be a fairly substantial change in our law. If you are in the third tier under federal law, you're required to register every quarter. If you're in our second tier, our life period, you're also required to register every quarter. The difference is that under the federal law, those registrations or any change in condition requires you to register in person. So, for example, a person who lives in Eek, or let's even a hub, a Bethel, would be required every time they move from their brother-in-law's house to their sister-in-law's house to fly to Anchorage, register in person. The federal law requires that under present Alaska law, your first offense for failure to register or maintain the information that you're supposed to is a misdemeanor offense, and your second offense is a felony. Under Adam Walsh, all offenses are felonies. So, for example, the person in Eek or in Bethel who moves and doesn't fly to Anchorage to tell the troopers there that they've moved would be committing a felony offense. The impact on our the impact in just keeping track on public safety is more than the federal money that we would lose. And that doesn't count days in prison. That doesn't count how much it would cost to make all these offenders felony offenders. That's just how much public safety thinks it would cost them to administratively comply with the federal law. I'm trying to think of some of the other differences that exist
Maybe I could cut through.
Representative Grunberg, you have another question?
I definitely see where you're coming from, and which leads me to flip the coin over. And I would find it helpful if we could get from law a chart of the differences between Alaska law and the Adam Walsh Act, and the carrots that are out there, the grants, that because this act does not meet the Alaska situation, that we're not eligible for, what this is costing us. Because if in fact this is reasonable for other states, but not here, because we can't criminalize the bush, and wouldn't want to, that we are, because of our unique situation, not eligible for some significant federal money, with the idea of maybe through this committee or the members on the committee calling that matter to the attention of the federal government and our delegation to see if we could maybe get an exception or something that we can comply with. If we can't do one, maybe we can do the other. That's where I'm coming from. And if the Department of Law can get us the facts for that, maybe we can look at that in this committee to see whether we can get something done so that we can get the grants we need to protect the public. Could you help us with that through the chair?
Through the chair, that's in essence what the letters that I sent before did. Just outline the differences, how much it would, not how much it would cost us, because that's a, we have a better grasp now this last year of how much it would cost us, but how much we actually would lose. And I can tell you it's varied from year to year, from zero to about under $250,000. But I can easily provide that, because that's exactly what I did in the letters, set out the differences between Alaska law and the federal law, and the costs.
The chair, that would be helpful. We have filed a number of lawsuits through your department to try to get across to Washington the needs and unique situation here in Alaska. Maybe we can attack the problem in this piece of legislation a little differently and see what we can do to work with them to meet the Alaska ability and to get the money we need to conduct the business of law, public safety, and the rest. And I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair. If I may follow up on the other subject.
Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Safety. I happen to be on the Department of Law subcommittee and the court subcommittee, and we've been looking at the issue of safety in court buildings, and I don't recall whether we were doing it in the Department of Law, etc. But I know prosecutors, police, and also family lawyers, of which I used to be one, sometimes face the wrath of the public, people who are unbalanced and dangerous. I would like to know in some more detail through this committee's oversight responsibilities, if nothing else, in some detail, I don't care if this is in writing, maybe it ought to be a subject of a separate hearing or something, what you need, why you need it, what it would take to meet that need, and the cost. You want to take a stab at that now or get back in writing?
Through the chair, what we need is an audit to know what we need. Where we as non-professionals can see an issue, we have tried to and are trying to address those issues. And the legislature has been very good to us about that. For example, you have appropriated money so that so that the entire Anchorage District Attorney's Office can be key carded. It's a simple thing, but it's a safety measure, and we within the last month have completed that project. I mean, we have, I brought it up because it had been an issue before, and members of the committee had asked about it. I wanted to let you know we're working the issue. The Attorney General has been on the job a month, and he went to Barrow, and he came back and said, we need, you know, I want this constructed this way, that, you know, and that, and we're doing that. We're in the process of getting that. He saw an issue, but I don't believe he's a security professional, and we want to do an audit of all these facilities to see what we're missing. And so we are working on these. Piecemeal sounds the wrong way, but when we see an issue, we're dealing with it, and the legislature has been good to us in recognizing those concerns and, like I said, appropriating money for us to do things like key.
May I follow up with one more final question?
Representative Grunberg?
I would appreciate it if you could get a letter to the members of this committee and the Department of Law subcommittee stating specifically what kind of an audit you would like and if you know the cost.
Mr. Chairman, we will do that.
Thank you very much.
I would, if I may.
Yes.
I agree with Representative Grunberg. Family lawyers are probably more at risk than the prosecutors. You know, I've been a prosecutor for 35 years, and I've been threatened 3 times with guns, but they were always in the first 2 years, and I was doing family law work.
And for the record, I've been threatened. I've had judges threatened. It's not a laughing matter. I've had clients kill themselves and children. It's a very serious thing. It's very sad. Thank you. I'm sorry.
All right. Are there any other questions from members? Hearing none, Mr. Slobotny and Ms. Carpinetti, we thank you very much for your informative presentation. This committee looks forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Our next Judiciary Committee meeting will be at 1 p.m. on Friday, February 4th. 2011, and at this meeting we will hear an overview of the Department of Corrections and House Bill 7, which is dealing with synthetic cannabinoids as a Schedule 2A drug. So at that, it is 1:07 p.m. or 2:07 p.m. and I adjourn this meeting.